All right, 1 Kings chapter 6, if you have a Bible. 1 Kings chapter 6. We are still right in the middle of examining the reign of King Solomon. We have seen that the reign of King Solomon kind of neatly subdivides into three major chunks. Each chunk is it contains either a word from the Lord directly, where God visits Solomon in a dream, or indirectly as he sends word through a prophet. That'll be the final section in 1 Kings 11. But we see the reign of Solomon kind of subdivides into these three big chunks. He first requests and demonstrates wisdom from God. That's chapters 3 and 4 of the book of 1 Kings. And then we find ourselves in the middle section, which is kind of the core of his reign, and at least the record spends the most time on this. And this is where Solomon, by God's grace and his power, builds a mighty kingdom. And so last time, if you were with us, we looked at chapter 5. That was our examination last time, where in chapter 5, we see the gathering preparation, if you will, for the building of the temple in particular. But our focus this morning, beginning in chapter 6, and we'll see how far we make. I'd like to read, actually, a big chunk this morning. Not that we'll see if we can conclude that whole section. But chapter 6 and 7 really hangs together as a record of Solomon's building projects. And so there's a lot to say in this section, but what I want you to see is really three big ideas. First, we're going to see chapter 6, verse 1 opens with what you might call a date that celebrates Yahweh's redemption. And we're going to come back probably next week or the week after. We'll see when we get there to give a whole section, you know, a whole lecture to that concept. But in fact, 1 Kings 6, 1 has been labeled as the most important verse in the Old Testament for chronology. It helps us understand from a chronological standpoint just the way that the narrative of the Old Testament unfolds, but also it helps us anchor the date to outside sources. And so very important verse from that regard. So I want to give that due attention, but we'll probably look at that, if not next week, the one after. But then not only do we see it begins with a date that celebrates redemption, but also we'll see a description that reflects Yahweh's splendor. That's really the entirety of chapter 6 and 7, is describing the splendor of the temple, the glory of the temple, the wealth displayed in the temple. And it is, again, a description fitting the splendor of Yahweh. And then, of course, we'll see also a declaration that underscores Yahweh's priority, And that is right in the middle of the process. As Solomon is in the process of building the temple, God speaks to him and reasserts. He reminds Solomon of the idea of the Davidic covenant and what God is promising and prioritizing through the history of Israel. And so there's a lot to see in this section, but I think it's kind of interesting. As one scholar put it, he says, you know, some people have a hard time through this section. And it's kind of like he likened it to a man trying, you know, to a husband trying to listen to his wife as she's really excited about interior decorating. You know what I'm saying? She's got all these ideas of the kitchen remodel, and she's going long and hard on the colors and this and that and the other thing. And most men find it difficult to engage in animated conversation about colors of the bathroom or something else. But so as we read this section, it almost has that feel to it. But you should see that the whole point of it is the original author, I think he's functioning as an eyewitness. He was there. He's seeing this. But he is standing in awe, as we should, of the glory and the splendor of Yahweh's temple and the blessing and power of Yahweh that is reflected through it. And so that's really the main theme, idea that is behind this section. So let's begin by just reading. Let's just start with verse 1, make a couple comments, and then we'll read the larger section. 1 Kings 6, 1 says, "And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord." Notice the incredible amount of detail on timing that is anchored to this verse. It's really remarkable in that regard. But what I want you to see is, again, we're going to come back. I'm going to make a couple of comments on this morning, but then we're going to punt it to next week or the week after when we get to it. But this section begins with a date. And you see this several times in the scripture where there is a very significant, momentous occasion in redemptive history that is very carefully dated. For instance, the birth of Jesus, right? In Luke 3, the beginning of his ministry, Luke 3. His birth kind of dated in chapter 2, but the beginning of his ministry and the beginning of John the Baptist is given like 6 criteria in history so that we can nail it down exactly when it happened in Luke chapter 3. And we see several examples of that in the scripture. For instance, the Exodus itself is a fulfillment of an earlier promise. Remember Exodus chapter 12, verse 41, you don't need to go there for sake of time, but it tells us that God released the children of Israel from Egypt in the Exodus right on time, according to God's promise that he had given to Abraham centuries prior. And we see the idea being that God is exact, and these moments in history are very important. And that's what we see here, as he begins by dating it 480 years after the Exodus. More on that later, but that's the most important chronological statement in the Old Testament. It helps us understand because we can nail down the fourth year of Solomon with really uncontested evidence. We know when Solomon's fourth year is. Well, then you back up 480 years, now we know where the Exodus is. And there is a big debate on that. We'll talk about it later. We've talked about it before in our study of the book of Exodus. But this is, again, heralded as the most important verse for Old Testament chronology. But we'll deal with chronology later. What I want to talk about this morning is theology. In other words, this is a theologically important statement just as much as chronology. And the idea is that it is anchoring this event in redemptive history. But redemptive history is still history. And that's where we'll make a bigger deal of that later. But the Bible is real history. It's real people, real places, real events. We can figure out when it happened, where it happened, who was there, what happened. The Bible is so easily reconstructed because it's real history. And so more on that later. I know that's a preoccupation of mine, but we'll come back to that concept. But it's also redemptive history. In other words, it's the history of what God is doing throughout human history. How is he going to redeem not just the nation of Israel, but also through them, the entirety of the human race? The story of God's redemption. The Bible is the record of redemptive history. And so it's interesting that as we see, it is rooted in real history. It gives us a time, place, date. But it also is making the point that God is making and keeping promises. But I think it's interesting. We made this point at the end of last week, the end of the hour last week, is that God's timetable is not our timetable. Right? When we look at this, God tells the nation of Israel that they're going to be in Egypt for 4 centuries. And then after that, God promised that he would bring them into the promised land. He promised that he would build a temple. However, that takes place over 4 centuries later, almost 5 centuries, 480 years after the Exodus is when now the temple is being built. Now, you and I, from our perspective, if you look at where we're at and then you go back 480 years, we're talking about the time of the Reformation. How many of you know what happened during the Reformation? I mean, you might know the term. You probably lost sight of the dates, names, characters, etc. The point is, that's a long time ago. And the concept is that when Solomon is building the temple, this is marking a momentous occasion in redemptive history that is, according to the text at least, it's he wants us to remember it in light of the Exodus. In other words, God is just like he made and fulfilled a promise rather dramatically in the Exodus event. Well, here it is happening again, is God has made a promise that is now being fulfilled. And so the narrator wants to slow down, make that point, and help us understand the glory of what we are about to read, as God is building the temple. And so this is a very important situation, scene. But let's then get into the description itself. Now, I would suggest to you, right before we read this, all right, I want you to think through it as if you are an Old Testament Israeli, and try and understand that why you're really trying to answer this question. Why would the writer spend so much space depicting the interior of the house, particularly in opposition to the exterior? We're going to read the description in just a moment. I think it's worth the time to just read it. But as we read the description, I want you to place yourself in the perspective of an Old Testament Israeli and realize that this, for your average Israeli, which is most of, you know, again, most of the nation, a large percentage of the nation, your average Israeli would never have seen the interior of the temple. They were not allowed inside of this. They saw the exterior, they saw the glory, they saw the splendor, But the point is, they will never enter into the glories of the temple. And so what these chapters are doing is not only giving an eyewitness account of the glory, the splendor, the wealth, et cetera, that's on display at the temple, but it's also giving you an audio tour that if you're an average Israeli, you get a glimpse into the temple. And praise God, we, several thousand years removed from this, nonetheless, we also are able to tune in to this audio tour. And so this is an awesome description, and it ought be jaw-dropping as we work our way through. And that's the whole point. So let's take the time to read this section in its entirety. So if you got a Bible, just follow along as I read. But I'm going to read from 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 2. And then I would like to read all the way through chapter 7. It's a pretty good sized chunk, okay? So take a deep breath, sip your coffee, hang in there, okay? 1 Kings 6, verse 2. It says, "The house which King Solomon built for the Lord, the length thereof was 60 cubits, the breadth thereof 20 cubits, and the height thereof 30 cubits. I'll show you, we'll zoom in on that diagram here in a moment, and I'll just kind of walk you through it visually. But just, again, sit back and try to visualize this as we read the description. Verse 3. "The porch there, or before the temple of the house, was 20 cubits was the length thereof, according to the breadth of the house, and 10 cubits was the breadth thereof, according to the house. For the house he made windows of narrow lights, and against the wall of the house he built chambers round about, against the walls of the house round about, both of the temple and of the oracle, and he made chambers round about." Now again, the temple would be the, kind of that outer room, the oracle would be the inner room, also known as the Holy of Holies. Verse 6. "The nethermost chamber was 5 cubits broad. The middle was 6 cubits broad. The third was 7 cubits broad. For without, in the wall of the house, he made narrow rests round about, and the beams should not be fastened in the walls of the house. And the house, when it was in building, was built of stone, made ready before it was brought thither, so that there was neither," this is an interesting tidbit, remember this? "There was neither hammer nor axe or any tool of iron heard in the house while it was being built." Isn't that interesting? All the hammering, all the noise was off-site. And then they would bring the blocks one by one to the building site and put it together. I don't know if any of you have, I know a few of you do, an engineering background, but oh my word, the amount of preparation and math and oh my word, that's a lot of details. But when you think about the logistics of this, we talked about that a little bit more last week, but it is stunning. That's the whole point. Verse 8. "The door in the middle chamber was the right side of the house, and they went up with winding stairs to the middle chamber and out of the middle into the third." All right, so you actually have 3 levels. We'll see it in a picture in a minute. "So he built the house and finished it and covered the house with beams and cedars and boards of cedar." We talked about those last time. Remember the famous cedars of Lebanon? That was last week. Verse 10. "And when he built chambers against all the house, 5 cubits high, and they rested in the house with timber of cedar." Now that's just a really quick glance at the exterior and kind of the big picture architecture. But then notice this is where he inserts, as I mentioned a moment ago, this is the priority. This is God's priority. He's reminding Solomon right in the middle of the construction as to the purpose of it. Verse 11, "The word of the Lord came to Solomon saying," and we don't know if this came in a dream by night or if it came through a messenger, a prophet, it doesn't say, it just says the word of the Lord came to him saying, verse 12, "Concerning the house which you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and execute my judgments, and keep all my commandments to walk in them, then will I perform my word with you, which I spoke unto David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel, and will not forsake my people Israel." Notice how it's essentially reminding him of the Davidic covenant. We've talked about that often. That is the centerpiece of your Old Testament. If you don't understand the Davidic covenant, you don't understand your Old Testament. That is the core of the Old Testament, is this set of promises God made to David. All, in a sense, all the promises kind of before him or leading up to him, and then after David and those promises that from him would be a forever king who would rule over the forever kingdom, who would bring peace and prosperity to planet Earth. That concept is then every promise after David is looking back to that set of promises. And we'll see that even a little bit in the morning session as we're talking about the coming of Christ and the glorious kingdom that he is setting up. It's the fulfillment of the Davidic covenant and all the covenants, but particularly the Davidic. So understand that God is reminding Solomon of the importance of that. But and he's speaking in the positive, right? I will bless you, but there's a condition. If you remain faithful, I will not forsake you. So inherent to the blessing, inherent to the promise of blessing, there is also a threat, is there not? And as we've already seen, and we will see much more dramatically later, Solomon experiences both the blessing, because he's obedient to God, at least during the first half of his reign, and he experiences the curse, the threat, and particularly, you know, the Israel after him experiences the threat because of his unfaithfulness. But let's keep reading. Verse 14. So again, it's inserting the theological significance of this scene. It is a partial fulfillment of the Davidic covenant when God is building the temple, because he said he would do that to David. Verse 14. Now, so Solomon built the house and finished it. And he built the walls of the house within the boards of cedar, both the floor of the house and the walls of the ceiling. And he covered them on the inside with wood and covered the floor of the house with planks of fir. He built 20 cubits on the sides of the house, both the floor and the walls with boards of cedar. Again, that's expensive. The whole point, we made that point last time. But the cedars of Lebanon was the most highly coveted wood in the ancient world. We have it inside and outside the Bible mentioned numerous places. And so it was not cheap. But he continues, it says, in the house, that is the temple, before it was 40 cubits long. Verse 18, the cedar of the house within was carved with knops and open flowers. All was cedar. There was no stone seen. All right, so the exterior is stone. The interior is cedar. Verse 19, and the oracle he prepared in the house within to set there the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Notice he's calling it the oracle here. We call it the Holy of Holies from the book of Exodus. In fact, this works out really well, right? We just finished in our study of Exodus on Wednesday nights. We just finished looking at the wilderness tabernacle, the construction of it. And so now we're looking at the temple, which is just the permanent version of the wilderness tabernacle. But their purpose is the same. And so their construction, their layout is the same. The temple's just much more elaborate, much more expensive and valuable. But he calls it the oracle. Why? Remember? Pop quiz. You didn't know it was a quiz this morning, did you? It's Exodus 25. Remember this? Is God, they call it the oracle because the word oracle literally means, you know, from which, a place from which an oracle is given, a spoken word from the Lord. That's the idea. And so he says, and that's Exodus 25, is God says, build the Ark of the Covenant, and above the cherubim is where God, his presence, the glory cloud, literally hovers above the cherubim. And he says, that is where, from whence I will speak to the children of Israel, he says. And we see several examples of that in the Old and not the New Testament, because the Ark's gone by then. But in the Old Testament, we see several examples of that where God speaks directly to Moses mainly. We have a couple other examples later after Moses, but where he can go directly into the presence of God. He can ask a question. God speaks to him audibly from the above the cherubim, above the Ark of the Covenant. So that's why it's called the oracle. Is it's the place from where God, it's where God's presence is immediately manifested and from whence they can talk to God. So in other words, we can put it this way, it's the most sacred place on planet Earth. That's the point. It's where God's immediate presence resided in the era of the Old Testament. Remarkable. And this is, by the way, why there is so much fighting over this in the modern day between Jews and Muslims. Some of you have been with me on the Temple Mount, right by it. And the holiest place on planet Earth is where this temple stood, where the Holy of Holies once was, and where the Dome of the Rock currently is. And there's I think, significance to that site, not only in past history, but in present and future history. And so there's stuff that's coming. So it's the most sacred place on planet Earth in the era of the Old Testament. That's what I want you to see. So verse 20, and the oracle, and the fore part was 20 cubits in length, 20 cubits in breadth, 20 cubits in the height thereof. So it's about a 30-foot cube is the idea. And he overlaid it with pure gold and so covered the altar, which was of cedar. Okay, so its interior is cedar, but then he overlays the entire interior. We're going to keep reading. But he overlays all of it with gold. It's remarkable. And gold, you know this? Gold can be spread out a really long ways. You can hammer it. Of course you know this. This is gold country. I mean, I'm talking to the choir here, right? You guys all know this. But it was interesting when my wife and I were just recently in downtown Boston on our little 15th anniversary getaway. Her sister lives there, and she was giving us a tour. And we walk past the state building in downtown Boston. And the dome, it's smaller than the Dome of the Rock, but it's the dome on top of that is actually covered with pure gold. And it's a pretty good-sized dome. I don't know the exact dimensions, but you know, visually it's pretty good size. And yet she said, if you took all that gold and just put it into a ball, it'd be about this big. But you can actually take it and hammer it out so thinly, it covers an incredible, surface area. And so that's what they're going to do on the inside of this temple, is they're going to take and they're going to cover everything with gold. More on that later. So, 22, the whole house he overlaid with gold until he finished all the house. Also, the whole altar that was by the oracle, he overlaid it with gold. That would be the incense altar, the golden altar on the inside. It says next to the oracle. That's not the brazen altar outside. We're still talking inside the temple there. Verse 23, and within the oracle, he made two cherubim of olive tree. Interesting, made out of olives, which makes you wonder if it's connected to the Zechariah prophecy, but that's a story for another day. He says, but the two cherubim of olive tree, each 10 cubits high, and 5 cubits was the wing of the cherub, and 5 cubits the other wing of the cherub. From the uttermost part of one wing to the uttermost parts of the other was 10 cubits. In other words, these two cherubim, their wings span the entirety of the Holy of Holies, and they touch in the middle. So it was this was the centerpiece of kind of the architectural, interior. 25. And the other cherubim, they were one size. The height of the cherubim was 10 cubits, so was the other cherub. Verse 27. And he set the cherubim within the inner house, and they stretched forth the wings of the cherubims, so that the wing of the one touched the wall, and the wing of the other touched the other wall, and their wings touched one another in the midst of the house. And he overlaid the cherubim with gold. Again, made out of olive wood, but then overlaid with gold. Verse 29. And he carved all the walls of the house round about with carved figures of cherubim and palm trees, open flowers within and without. Now that's inlaid into the gold, right? They make all these structures. But do you see how that parallels so much of what we talked about in the book of Exodus? Remember one of the functions of the wilderness tabernacle? And in this case, the temple, which is the permanent version of it, is it's a recreation of the Garden of Eden. It's a flashback to the Garden of Eden, where God once walked with man, and mankind had perfect fellowship and harmony with God, and they spoke one with another. That's why, again, the oracle. This is where men meet with God in this era. And it's a recreation in a architectural sort of sense. It's a recreation. It's a flashback to Eden. Verse 30, so the floor of the house he overlaid with gold within and without. For the entering of the oracle, he made doors of olive tree. The lintel and side posts were a fifth part of the wall. The two doors were also of olive tree, and he carved upon them carvings of cherubim, palm trees, open flowers, overlaid them with gold, spread the gold upon the cherubims and upon the palm trees. And it was, again, just that kind of the tree flower sort of motif. Verse 33, so also made he for the door of the temple posts of olive tree, a fourth part of the wall. And two doors were of fir tree, and the two leaves of one door were folding. The two leaves of the other door were folding. And he carved thereon cherubim and palm trees, open flowers, and covered them with gold fitted upon the carved work. That's another motif. We pointed that out in the wilderness tabernacle study in the book of Exodus. But why are there cherubim everywhere? Well, remember, what's the first mention of cherubim in the Bible? Where does it show up? Genesis 3. Right after Adam and Eve sin, they partake of the forbidden fruit. They are exiled from the Garden of Eden, and God places at the entrance to the garden, what? Cherubim, right? And so the idea is they are guarding the presence of God. Because of the sinfulness of man, we have been exiled from the presence of God, and the cherubim guard the sanctity of God's presence. That's the whole point, right? It's the big theme here, is that these cherubim are everywhere throughout the temple. But it's a flashback to Eden, that when we have fellowship with God through the sacrifice, and the priests who represent the nation are able to enter into the direct presence of God, they have to pass the cherubim into the holy place from which God, the Holy of Holies place, from which God speaks, the oracle, and they have renewed fellowship with God. It's like they're entering back through the gate into the Garden of Eden where they can speak with God. Right? That's the idea. That's the picture that should conjure up in your mind. Verse 36. And he built the inner court with 3 rows of hewn stone and a row of cedar beams. And the fourth year was the foundation of the Lord laid in the month of Ziph. We're going to come back to that. That's that chronological marker I mentioned earlier, most important in the Old Testament. He says, and in the 11th year, the month of Bul, which was in the 8th month, was the house finished. So it took him 7 years to complete it throughout all the parts thereof, according to all the fashion of it. So he was 7 years in building it. Keep reading. Chapter 7, verse 1. But Solomon was building his own house 13 years and finished all his courts. Let's actually skip 1 to 12, because that is other building programs. We're going to come back to that, where Solomon's building his own house, his own palace, etc. So pick up the story in verse 13, chapter 7, verse 13. That's where he continues to talk about the temple, particularly the interior furnishings. He says, "And Solomon sent and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. He was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali. His father was a man of Tyre, a worker in brass, and he was filled with wisdom, understanding, and cunning to work all works in brass, and he came to King Solomon and wrought all of his work." This is the guy we talked about him last time. Remember the alliance between Israel and Tyre at this time. And this worker, who's the main guy, who is the artist for the temple, kind of the architect slash artist, he's actually, he's a half-breed. He's half Israeli and half Phoenician, right? His father was a man of Tyre, an expert worker in brass. But he, remember, we read this last time from Chronicles' account, he was of which tribe? His mother was of which tribe, you remember? Dan. Yeah, that's right, Danite. So I think it's interesting not to just get lost in this, but remember, this is real people, real events. You know, this is real history. So I think it's interesting. Just like the Apostle Paul later, God providentially works in our lives to give us the background necessary so that he can use us for his honor and for his glory. I think it's remarkable. When we, for instance, that was Utibica this year when I was up at camp, we did a snapshot of the life of Paul, and we did all this background study in like his, he grew up in, you know, Hellenistic Tarsus, so he was a Jew, steeped in Greek culture. He knew multiple languages. He was an expert in the Old Testament because he was of the Pharisee. He had Pharisee training. You could go on and on and on. All of that before he became a Christian. And the background was perfect. God designed it so that when he becomes a Christian, he becomes the apostle of the Gentiles and he writes half the New Testament, right? I mean, he's kind of an important guy. Well, in this sense, we see, look at the background. He's Jewish. So he has, you know, he has a Jewish mother. And he has an interest of in the things of God, Yahweh, the true God of Israel. And he's the guy who's going to be building the temple. But his background is he's half Phoenician. And his dad is the expert in working. He's the artificer in brass, you know, in Phoenicia. And he is like tailor-made for this job. That's the point. And then you could pause. And I mean, this is a sermon within a sermon, but I feel a sermon coming on. You know what I'm saying? There's a pretty good application lesson there for us, isn't there? Is what is it in your background that God has used to make you useful for his purposes? It's remarkable. God does not waste time. Rather, he invests even our faults and our failures. God can so graciously turn around and use them for his glory. It's a remarkable thing. Sometimes the lessons we've learned through the bitterness of failure is actually the comfort with which God comforts us, we can go and comfort others, 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Right? It's really remarkable. We could spend a whole rest of the hour just on that, but I draw your attention to it. Hiram, but a rather interesting dude. Keep reading, verse 15. "For he cast two pillars of brass, 18 cubits high apiece." We're going to come back to these. These two pillars are the centerpiece. He spends a lot of ink just describing these pillars. So I think there's a significance to that. We'll come back to it. "For he cast two pillars of brass, 18 cubits high apiece. The line of the 12 cubits did compass either of them about." So they're very wide, big. 16, "and he made two," these are like modern day, we would use the term capital, right? It's the idea is that it's that which is atop the pillar. "Of molten brass set on the tops of the pillars. The height of one," capital is our modern term, "was 5 cubits, and the height of the other was 5 cubits. And the nets of the checker work and the wreaths and chain work for the capitals were upon the top of the pillars. 7 for one capital, 7 for the other. He made the pillars and the two rows round about upon one network to cover the capitals that were upon the top with pomegranates. So he did with the other capital." Notice again, the pomegranate theme, back to the Garden of Eden. A lot of garden type imagery here. Do you see it? Verse 19, "the capitals were upon the top of the pillars of lily work in the porch, 4 cubits. The capitals upon the two pillars were pomegranate also above, over against the belly, which was the network, and the pomegranates were 200 in rows round about upon the other capital. And he set upon the pillars in the porch of he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple." And he, in other words, these were visible from the outside. If you were an average Israeli, you can't go inside. But this is the most striking feature of the outside of the temple. So I'll show you pictures of that in a second, just artist recreations of it. Says he set up the right pillar and called the name of it Yakin. And he set up the left pillar and called the name of it Boaz. All right, so the names are significant. We're going to come back to that, but there's meaning built into the names. Verse 22, and upon the top of the pillars was lily work so that the work of the pillars was finished. Then he made a molten sea, 10 cubits from the one from the one brim to the other. It was round all about, and its height was 5 cubits. The line of 30 cubits did compass it round about. And under the brim of it, round about, were knops compassing it, 10 in the cubit, compassing the sea, round about. The knops were cast in the two rows when it was cast. And it stood upon 12 oxen, 3 looking to the north, 3 looking to the west, 3 looking to the south, and 3 toward the east. The sea, sometimes called the brazen sea, was set above them on the hinder parts and were inward. In other words, they were outward facing. Verse 26, and it was the handbreadth thick. From the rim thereof, it was wrought like the brim of a cup, and the flowers of the lilies, it contained 2,000 baths. One of the things that you should notice in this description, again, this is just fortuitous, providential, that we just finished studying the Wilderness Tabernacle in the book of Exodus, if you've been with us on our Wednesday night study. But notice the same pieces of furniture that God commanded to be built in the book of Exodus are also being built here, but they're being built on a far grander scale. That's what I want you to see. Massive, you know, like way bigger. But this is really a story for another time. We won't take the time today to do this. But if you compare this temple, Solomon's temple, with what is coming, Ezekiel's temple, that Ezekiel tells us about, Ezekiel's temple is way bigger. Like way bigger. I have to look at the stats again, but it's like four times bigger, something like that. It's very large. And so the idea is, notice, it's growing in grandeur. That's what I want you to see. Is the Wilderness Tabernacle was impressive, but it was modest in comparison to this. And this temple, which is impressive, is modest in comparison with what's coming in the book of Ezekiel. But let's keep going. Verse 27. And he also made 10 bases of brass or bronze, 4 cubits in the length of one base, the 4 cubits the breadth thereof, and 3 cubits the height thereof. And the work of the bases was on this manner. They had borders, and the borders between the ledges. I'll show you a picture of this in a minute. But these were smaller basins that could make the water from the big sea. They could, you know, take it from the big sea, put it in these smaller basins, and move it around the temple courtyard. And so it made the washing much easier. This is upgraded, by the way, when we get to the New Testament in Herod's temple. And I'm lost on this because, I mean, I could get lost in this information. It's so fascinating to me. But by the time we get to the New Testament, Herod the Great builds mammoth temple, right? Because this one by Solomon's destroyed by the Babylonians, 586 BC. But when it's rebuilt by, you know, Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, and then it's expanded by Herod, and that's the temple Jesus would have walked in the New Testament. They actually had running water. They built elaborate aqueducts to actually bring water from Bethlehem, miles away, like, I forget, 5, 6, 7 miles away, and they pipe it into the temple. And so they upgraded the water system over time. That's what I want you to see. And the book of Ezekiel also talks about the upgraded water system, if you know what I'm talking about. And that's coming in the millennium, I would argue. But let's keep reading. Verse 29, is that where it was? On the borders between the ledges were lions, oxen, and cherubim. Interesting. Why lions, oxen, and cherubim? Because remember, the cherubim have multiple faces. Remember that? Faces like lion, ox, eagle, man. It says, and upon the ledges of the base thereof, and beneath the lions and the oxen were certain additions made of thin work. And every base had 4 brazen wheels. So that, again, they're mobile, right? You can move them around. The plates of brass. 4 corners thereof had undersetters. Under the laver were undersetters molten, at the side of every addition. And the mouth of it within the top, the capital, above it was a cubit. But the mouth thereof was round after the work of the base. A cubit and a half was also upon the mouth of it, gravings with their borders, 4 square, not round. Under the borders were 4 wheels. The axle trees of the wheels were joined to the base. Again, do you get this is like exhausting detail. But notice the guy, the eyewitness, is like, he's walking around this thing. He's giving you every single detail in written form. right? He's giving you the audio tour. He's even telling you the axles that are on these things. I'm like, okay, dude, I get it. Like, move on. But he is fascinated. You know what I'm saying? The wheels were joined at the base. The height of the wheel was a cubit and a half of half a cubit. The work of the wheels was like the work of a chariot wheel. See, he's trying to give us a good mental image. It looks kind of like a chariot wheel. Their axle trees, their naves, their fellows, and their spokes were all molten. So one big piece, one big solid wheel. Verse 34, and there were four undersetters to the four corners of the base, and the undersetters were of the very base itself. And in the top of the base, there were a round compass of half a cubit high, and on the top of the base, the ledges thereof and the borders thereof were of the same. And on the plates of the ledges thereof and the borders thereof, he graved, guess what? Here we are again, cherubim, lions, palm trees, according to the proportion of every one, and additions around the top. Notice again, Garden of Eden. Think that it should just be pounded into your head over and over as we read this description. It's a flashback to the Garden of Eden. After this manner, he made the 10 bases, all of them one casting, one measure, and one size. So they're all identical size. Once he made the cast, he made 10 of them right in a row. Verse 38. Then he made 10 lavers of brass. One laver contained 40 baths, and every laver was 4 cubits. Upon every one, the 10 bases, one laver. Right, so the base is what makes it mobile, but there's now a basin on top of it to hold the water. So we put 5 basins on the right side of the house, 5 on the left side of the house, and he set the sea on the right side of the house eastward over against the south. And Hiram made the lavers and the shovels and the basins. So Hiram made an end of doing all the work that he had made King Solomon for the house of the Lord. The 2 pillars and the 2 bowls of the capitals that were on top of the 2 pillars, and the 2 networks to cover 2 bowls and the capitals, which were upon the top of the pillars, and 400 pomegranates. That's a lot of pomegranates. For the 2 networks, even 2 rows of pomegranates for 1 network to cover the 2 bowls of the, again, capitals that were upon the pillars, and the 10 basins and the 10 lavers on the basins, and the 1 sea, 12 oxen under the sea. So he's just kind of giving us a review of what he just said. And the pots and the shovels and the basins, all these vessels which Hiram made to King Solomon for the house of the Lord were of bright brass or bronze. In the plain of Jordan did the king cast them. Interesting, because remember, there's no, you can't have the sound of work on the temple. It was just one more way on the temple site. They were trying to keep it sanctified. And it's a remarkable achievement. So he says the casting of the bronze took place in the Jordan River Valley. Now, do you remember this? I mentioned this. Was it last week? 2 weeks ago. I mentioned that archaeologists have actually discovered what are known as King Solomon's mines. They were copper mines. Bronze requires a mixture between copper and tin. And what's interesting is the bronze working of the Old Testament, he's probably working down in those mines. And what's interesting, remember, they've been discovered in modernity, but they obviously have been worked out. There's not much copper left there. It's not like Kennecott Copper Mine, you know what I'm saying, over in Utah. But the copper mines are worked out in the Jordan Valley. But what's interesting is, do you remember they built it? Do you remember this? It's kind of fun. They built it to where to smelt the ore. They built it to where it would catch the prevailing winds, because there's a very dramatic wind shift down around the Dead Sea. We kind of experience it here about between two and four every day, right? You know, the whole heat exchange and the wind shift, and when we got this, you know, crazy wind that blows around. Well, it's the same thing over there, okay? But they built the mines in such a way, the smelting centers next to the mines, in order to catch that wind and to superheat the ovens so that they could smelt the ore. And so it makes total sense that Hiram is down in the Jordan River Valley. You know, he's working probably nearby those mines, and that's where he's doing all the casting. And then they bring this stuff up to the temple. And it's a bit of a walk, okay? It's about a 20-mile trek, and you got to make about almost 4,000-foot elevation change. So it's like hiking the dome, okay? If you've ever hiked the dome, that's about a 4,000-foot elevation change, isn't it? Ish? Okay. So that's like, yeah, it's, you know, it's pretty steep. So where was I? I distract myself. Verse 46, in the plain of Jordan did the king cast them, and in the clay ground between Succoth and Zarath, or Zartan, rather. Verse 47, and Solomon left all the vessels unweighed because they were exceeding many. In other words, he's like, guys, stop counting. Like, I'm getting sick of this. There is so much wealth in this temple. That's the point. He stopped counting. Neither was the weight of the brass found out. And Solomon made all the vessels that pertained to the house of the Lord, the altar of gold, the table of gold, whereupon the showbread was, the candlesticks of pure gold. So outside is bronze or brass. Inside the temple is gold. Everything, all the pieces of furniture on the inside are pure gold. So that is the same as the wilderness tabernacle. We just finished studying that on Wednesday nights, but that's the same. So, but there's more, right? The candlesticks of pure gold, five on the right and five on the left. So more than, right? Because there's only one candlestick built in Exodus. Now there's 10, right? Because the house is so much bigger. They need more light. And so they're spreading it around. So five on the right, five on the left, before the oracle with the flowers and the lamps and the tongs of gold and the bowls and the snuffers and the basins and the spoons and the censers of pure gold, the hinges of the gold, both for the doors of the inner house. So even the hinges are gold. And the inner house, the most holy place, for the doors of the house, to wit, of the temple. So, don't you feel a breath of fresh air? Whew. So was ended all the work King Solomon made for the house of the Lord. And Solomon brought in the things which David his father had dedicated. In other words, the temples, more on that in a moment, but they often functioned as ancient treasuries. So he deposits inside the temple all the things which David his father had dedicated, even the silver, the gold, the vessels, which did he put among the treasures of the house of the Lord. Now circle that, treasures of the house of the Lord. We're going to see that phrase come up a dozen times in the history of Israel from here forward, but more on that later. But the point is, as soon as he finishes building, he deposits all this treasure on the inside. Now, let me give you, after the audio tour, because now we have the ability to make, you know, computer-generated images and all this cool stuff. So we can do a visual tour real quick. But there's many scholars, many different renditions of this. This is just the one that I found most helpful. Let's just kind of notice a couple of those details that we read about a moment ago. Notice again, Solomon's temple began to be built, Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. Remember the significance, what's Mount Moriah? That's where Abraham offered up Isaac, right? In Genesis 22, don't miss the imagery there. But he begins to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah in the spring of 967 or 66. We'll talk about that next time. It's a very important chronological marker. But it took him 7 years to complete it. And it resided in the middle court with a boundary wall. Here is the metal basin, 15 foot in diameter, 7.5 feet tall. All right, so it's pretty good size. Again, I mean, especially for your average Jew, that's like my height. Okay, 7'5" that's getting up there for a guy like me. But it can hold 12,000 gallons of water. Okay, that's pretty impressive, pretty good size. And it's supported by 12 bronze oxen in sets of three, just as pictured there. Well, then here are the 10 bronze-wheeled stands with the basins of water to rinse off the ashes from the burnt offering. And again, this is just five because there's five on the other side. But the idea is, again, it's upgrading the water system because this is a much larger courtyard than the wilderness tabernacle ever was. There's only one basin built in Exodus, but there's the big basin here and then these 10 mobile things to move the water around to service the priests. Well, then let's zoom back out. The nave, which is this outer room, okay, you can see that. It's called the nave. It was 60 foot long and 30 foot wide. Now, this building, from this wall to that wall, is 60 feet. And I think, I forget what it is, like 55 wide or something like that-ish. Am I close on that? Yeah, I think front to back, that's 60 feet. All right, so just to visualize. So it would be a little more narrow than this building, but it would be the same, distance. So that just gives you a good visual of the inside, known as the nave, 60 feet long, 30 feet wide. There was a golden altar and a golden table there with five golden lampstands on either side. So total of 10. I don't know if you can see those. They're hard to distinguish, but there they are. The 10 golden lampstands. Then you had this, the table of showbread, the altar, the golden altar, it's sometimes called, or the incense altar, because they would offer incense on that. But then on the inside, all right, so the Holy of Holy place is a 30-foot cube. That's where the Ark of the Covenant would be, in the middle of these two massive 15-foot golden cherubim on either side. So notice the cherubim and their wings. That's as far in as I can zoom, okay? But that is the wings would touch the walls and then touch in the middle, right? So, and that, again, as we read the interior description, that's kind of the centerpiece, the most obvious, impressive part of the interior. But then externally, you also have, you can see kind of on the left side of the screen there, you have three level architecture. There's storerooms on the outside of the temple. There's some debate on this. Most believe that you had to access it from the outside so that your normal everyday Levite could go in there, because if they're not a priest, they can't go into the nave or the oracle, all right, the two inner rooms. So there's probably outside access to these storerooms, which come into play. How many, again, memorize this, burn this into your brain, okay? This will really help you later. But there's a cool story later. Do you remember when Athaliah, wicked Queen Athaliah, hijacks the temple? Oh, I'm sorry, the whole kingdom? And then they have to hide the true Davidic heir. Do you remember this? Okay, now I'm fast forwarding. That's like two or three centuries, you know, from this point. Okay, so like we got a lot of history to talk between now and then. But the high priest of the temple is the one who is hiding the true heir. And where does he hide him? In one of these storerooms. And he's a little kid. He's like, what was he, like 6 or 7? And then he hides him for like 2 years before they ultimately crown him king and take the throne back away from Athaliah. So we're going to get to that story in due time. If you're an avid Bible reader, you already know that story. But where do they hide the young Davidic monarch in these storerooms? Kind of interesting. So there were three levels to these storerooms. The lower level was 7.5 feet wide, and then they kind of get wider as they go up. The middle was 9 feet. The upper was 10.5. Then atop, the only other, again, there was this upper layer that seemed to be up above. Again, do you see the storeroom directly above the Holy of Holies? This is probably in the storerooms on the side and up above is where they're putting all the treasures. All right. Now, again, stay tuned on that. Like I said, over a dozen times throughout the history, the children of Israel are going to, and this, it actually, in a way, is an indicator. It's a barometer of how the nation is doing. The wealth that is in the temple. When they're obedient to God, then they defeat their enemies, they receive tribute from their enemies, and the temple is filled, booming, busting with treasure. But when the children of Israel are faithless, unfaithful to God, then enemies come in. We're going to read about the first one, all right? Right after Solomon dies, his son Rehoboam takes over. I know I'm forecasting just a little bit. But when Rehoboam walks away from God, what happens? King Shishak from Egypt. We actually have a temple built by Shishak. We know who he is. Extra biblically, we can reconstruct his life. Shishak from Egypt invades. And Rehoboam has to buy him off to get him to go away. And what does he do? He takes all the treasure from the temple. And so you'll see this over and over and over through history, is the temple is in many ways a microcosm of the nation. If the nation is obedient to God and faithful, then they're blessed and the temple is full of treasure. But as we'll see, Rehoboam, there's this pathetic line. And I think in a sense, it's really a footnote to Rehoboam's entire reign. It says the golden shields that were dedicated by David and Solomon were stolen by Shishak. Shishak, you know, the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, he plunders the temple and he goes back to Egypt. And Rehoboam is too, you know, broken. He doesn't have enough money to replace them. So he replaces what were once golden shields, he replaces them with bronze shields. And it's such a statement. It's like a footnote to his life. I read a commentary one time that was the title of it, you know, of the life of Rehoboam. At least when I think the chapter on Rehoboam was like, it was from gold to bronze. Like, what a downgrade, right? What an idiot, right? That's what the nation, that's what the whole chapter was about. Rehoboam had this incredible kingdom that he received from his father. And what did he do with it? He downgraded it. It went from gold to bronze because he was a loser. He would not obey God and he blew up the nation. Right? And it's like, wow. But in a sense, the temple is a microcosm of the nation. So it's helpful to visualize this and understand what's going on and to kind of get big picture. Okay. So, only other couple of things the nave, is called the clear story. I have a hard time with that word, but it's actually where it's like high up where there's windows high up. That's kind of, I don't know if you can see that in the picture. Where it would let natural light through. Then the vestibule or the porch on the outside was 30 foot wide, 15 foot deep. And that's where the bronze pillars were. So let's talk about that for just a moment. I've only got a couple minutes and then I'm out of time for the hour. Notice again, the bronze altar there, large, 30 foot by 15 foot. It's huge, way bigger than the one built by Solomon, or I'm sorry, by Moses. Solomon's is way bigger. And that'll be more than doubled in size when we get to Ezekiel's temple. But let's talk about these bronze pillars for just a moment. So this picture, let me just zoom out, go to the next picture. This is just, again, artist rendition of what the courtyard would look like and the outside of the temple as you're kind of, you know, approaching it from the outside. But most prominently seen, the most prominent piece of architecture from the outside are these two pillars. Now, let's revisit that real quick. They're huge. In fact, they're 27 feet high, and then they're capped with a capital that actually makes it up to 34 feet, 34 and a half feet high. So that's, somebody help me with my measurements, but your normal telephone pole is about 30 feet, right? So, and I have to measure the trees out here, but I think 34 is taller than that. So they're pretty good size, okay? They're very large. So they're 34 and a half feet tall. They're likely freestanding. There's nothing on top. They're not supporting anything, all right? So they're completely just kind of an architectural beauty. You know, it's just meant to beautify the outside. But it also is meant to make a statement because they name them two things, right? The one, I think it's on the left, is Yakin, and the one on the right would be Boaz. Now, if you translate those terms, Yakin and Boaz, then you get two phrases. Anyone familiar with this? Yakin means he shall or Yahweh shall establish. It shall be established. And then Boaz is with him is strength, or in him is strength. So these two, again, and I think Boaz translates into a phrase, but it's also a significant name. Who is Boaz? That's right. He's Ruth's husband. Have you read the book of Ruth recently? But even more important than being Ruth's husband, he is also the progenitor to David. This is all Davidic covenant language. That's what I want you to see. Is most scholars, there's some debate on this, but the large consensus is the purpose of these pillars, the reason they're named Yakin and Boaz, is to remind everyone who walks up to the temple, everyone who knows the names, everyone who sees the inscription, it is all about the Davidic covenant. That God has promised Yakin, and he will establish it, and he has the strength, he has the power to accomplish his promise. And the whole idea is what we just read earlier in chapter 6, right? Verse 12 and 13, where God, as Solomon is building this glorious temple, God shows up to him and he says, concerning the house which you are building, if you will walk in my statutes and execute my judgments and keep all my commandments to walk in them, then will I perform my word with you as I spake to David, your father. He brings up the Davidic covenant. He says, and I will dwell among you, the children of Israel, and will not forsake my people, Israel. It's a promise. And these two pillars are a constant reminder of the promise of God and his power to fulfill that promise. But as I said, inherent to the promise is also a threat. And as we will see, not only in Solomon's reign, but also everyone after him, is a fulfillment of this promise and or threat. If they're faithful to God, they enjoy the promise, the blessings that flow from it. If they're unfaithful to God, they suffer from the threat. And every king is then given a thumbs up or a thumbs down, right? Have you read Kings recently? He was either a good king, good job, or he was a bad king, thumbs down. And it all depended upon that comment. Were they faithful to the covenant or not? It all centers on that because God is a God of his word. He always keeps his word. Don't test him. Don't push him. He is always faithful to his word and he will keep his promises, but he will keep his threats. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for the time this morning as we just took the time to read these two rather lengthy chapters, but to try to visualize both from an audio tour as well as just computer generated images to try and help us understand what this glorious temple would have been like and what it means for just this glorious fulfillment of the promise of redemptive history, that not only did you bring Israel out of Egypt in the wilderness, but you promised a permanent place where you would place your name where your people could come and hear you speak, the oracle. Lord, the restored fellowship, the flashback to Eden, the access to the presence of God through the cherubim that guard his presence. Lord, all these glorious themes and pictures and ideas, it is a glorious display as we study the temple. It's a glorious display of theology, the truth of who you are, and the glory of our fellowship with you that you grant to us through the sacrifice, and how all of this pictures and points forward to the person and work of the Lord Jesus. Lord, as we look at the ultimate sacrifice, the whole book of Hebrews is built around this idea that as glorious as the tabernacle or temple once were, Jesus is better. The key phrase in the book of Hebrews, 14 times, better, better, better. What we have in Christ is far better. And I pray that you would help us as we study the details of this, as we visualize the importance of this, that we would see how it is, yes, central. It's a microcosm of Israel, central to Old Testament history, but also a picture and a foreshadowing of the person and work of Christ and the glories that we enjoy in the new covenant. Father, I pray that as we try to wrap our minds around this, that you would give us aid, that you would help us to understand beyond our own ability, Lord, what it is that you've placed here for our learning. So bless us, we pray, as we close this service and prepare for the next. We pray for next week as we just continue to study the life of Solomon. We ask that you would guide and direct in all that is said and done. In Christ's name we ask it. Amen.